From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. Jiminy Glick, the misinformed, self-absorbed celebrity talk show host created by Martin Short, is at it again on Comedy Central. On today's Fresh Air, we feature interviews with Martin Short. Primetime Glick has just begun season 3, and Short is also starring in the LA production of The Producers. Also, composer Burt Bacharach and lyricist Hal David. Bacharach turns 75 years old next week, and there's a new Broadway show featuring their songs. That's coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Police have surrounded a building at Case Western University in Cleveland where a gunman remains after having wounded at least two people. Janet Babin of member station WCPN is at the scene.
Authorities are saying that two people have been injured. A gunman opened fire in the Weatherhead School of Management building at Case Western Reserve University. That gunman is apparently still inside the building, as are several people who worked in the building and some students as well. One person has been injured inside the building and is still wounded inside the building. Another person was shot outside the building. That person has been taken to the hospital and is receiving medical treatment.
Reporter Janet Babin at Case Western University in Cleveland. The United States and its allies have taken their post-war plan for Iraq to the United Nations for approval. And the plan calls for U.S. and British forces to run Iraq as an occupying authority for at least a year and possibly longer. NPR's Tom Gelton reports from the Pentagon.
Bush administration officials and U.S. military commanders are anxious to get U.S. troops out of Iraq as soon as possible, but at every opportunity they also emphasize they'll stay as long as necessary. The draft UN resolution gives U.S. and British forces a 12-month authorization to run Iraq, but Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld suggested at a Pentagon briefing that a U.S. occupation could run longer.
I suspect that if someone's mentioning a year, it's probably just a review period, because anyone who thinks they know how long it's going to take is fooling themselves. It's not knowable.
About 135,000 U.S. troops are in Iraq now. Additional forces trained for policing are on their way, but some of those units could be supplied by other governments. Tom Gelton, NPR News, The Pentagon.
The House of Representatives has passed a $550 billion tax cut that's less than the president wanted, but more than is likely to pass the Senate. NPR's Andrea Seabrook reports.
The centerpiece of the bill is a reduction in taxes on stock dividends. The bill also includes a cut in capital gains taxes, a reduction in income tax rates in most brackets, and several small business provisions. House Speaker Dennis Hastert.
Let's get this economy going again. Vote for this package. Get America back on its feet. It's our responsibility to create that environment for the economy, and we have this chance to do it today. Let's do it. Thank you.
All but four Democrats voted against the package. Many charged it was designed to benefit the rich and would balloon the already record budget deficits. The Senate is set to debate its tax cut package next week. It amounts to about $350 billion. Andrea Seabrook, NPR News, The Capitol.
In stocks today, the Dow gained 113 points, or 1.3%, to close at 8,604 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq gained 30 points, or 2%. It closed at 1,520. This is NPR News. The Pentagon says three crewmen aboard a U.S. Army helicopter were killed today in a crash in northern Iraq. Another crewman aboard was injured. Officials say the Black Hawk helicopter crashed into the Tigris River between Baghdad and Tikrit. They say that the crash appears to have been an accident. Abortion foe James Kopp has received a maximum sentence of 25 years to life in prison for the 1998 murder of a suburban Buffalo, New York doctor. Lucy Nalpathanchil reports from member station WNED in Buffalo.
James Kopp spoke for more than an hour at his sentencing about his beliefs that led him to shoot Dr. Barnett Slepian, an obstetrician who provided abortions. Kopp says he is innocent of murder because he meant to injure, not kill, the doctor. He says he would gladly serve 10 more life sentences or even death sentences if that meant he could stop more abortions. His attorney, Bruce Barquette, says he will appeal.
It's certainly true that he did not intend to kill him.
Kopp still faces federal charges of interfering with the right to an abortion. He is also a suspect in the non-fatal shootings of four other doctors who performed abortions. For NPR News, I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil in Buffalo.
Oklahoma Governor Brad Henry says yesterday's tornado near Oklahoma City caused more than $100 million worth of damage. The storm wrecked hundreds of homes in the town of Moore and injured more than 100 people. It also damaged a big General Motors plant and a nearby Air Force base. GM officials said the plant will be shut down indefinitely. Governor Henry has declared disasters in two counties and is asking President Bush to help provide aid to the victims. In stocks today, the S&P 500 gained 13 points to close at 933. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
The NPR Online Shop features All Songs Considered, the CD series based on the music heard on All Things Considered at npr.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. Martin Short is taking on a new stage role, starring opposite Jason Alexander in a Los Angeles production of The Producers. Also, his TV series Primetime Glick has begun its third season on Comedy Central. The show is a satire of celebrity interview shows, with real celebrities showing up to endure the irreverent and often irrelevant questions by overweight talk host Jiminy Glick. Here's Martin Short as Jiminy, asking actor Brendan Fraser about his first movie role.
Ask you this. Your first film was Encino Man.
Yes.
Oh, I love that. You played Link.
I did, yeah.
Then you play a Jew. You played a Jewish man.
Yes, I did.
And that was risky to play a Jew in Hollywood. In the 90s. What went through your head taking that kind of risk?
Well, I made sure that it was a film that had meaning.
But why a Jew?
Well, the character was actually just a kid. He was a football player, and he just wanted to belong. And he was willing to do anything to be a part of a group, even to deny who he was fundamentally as a person.
That's wrong. That's wrong. You should embrace whoever you are.
Well, that was the point.
If you're a Buddhist, be happy you're a Buddhist. If you're Muslim, be happy that you're Muslim. If you're Episcopalian, hide that fact.
To Martin Short, obsessing about Hollywood and celebrity is nothing new. When he first visited Fresh Air in 1989, he told Terry about some of his childhood fantasies about show business.
Now, I've read about you that when you were young, you used to do an imaginary TV show in your room that would run on alternate weeks in your imagination with the Andy Williams Show.
Yes, that is very true, and we were canceled too, finally, which is a tragedy. Hullabaloo, I think, replaced us. Yes, I used to, it was 8:30 Mondays, in my mind.
Right.
And we'd tape ahead, you know, we'd have shows in the can, and I'd type things up for TV Guide, you know, highlights, Marty will sing, and I would come out, and I had a Frank Sinatra of the Sands album, so I used that as an applause record, and then, you know, I'd use intros from albums, and I'd have a guest, you know, my guest would be Tony Bennett, and Tony would come out and say, "Forget your troubles, come on, get happy. The Lord is waiting to take your hand." I'd sing another song, I just don't remember the words, you know, and he'd be my guest, and then I would, you know, sing with him, you know, with the record, and then I'd go to the applause, and I'd, you know, piece it together, reel to reel. And then I would take, the Playboy of that month and do the interview with Eldridge Cleaver or something, and, you know, I'd sit and you say that we're not moving fast, and, you know, and I'd then read his part, and then I'd end with a medley, and then someone would call dinner, and we'd tape later.
Did you sit on a stool and sing like Perry and Andy used to?
Oh, sure, yeah. But sometimes I just throw that stool aside and belt out a big final.
Because that's the kind of informal guy you are.
There was no one restraining me.
So, who were your sponsors?
Bulova Watch was a biggie. And the Kraft people.
they did.
No cigarettes even then.
They did Perry Como.
Yeah. Correct. Well, I know. They were very generous to help me out as well.
Why, if you were doing an imaginary show, would you have it alternate every other week with Andy Williams? Why not be on every
How
other
week?
How
could I do my films?
Every week, I mean. What?
How could I do my films?
Oh. Yes.
Remember,
yes,
I was directing as well.
No, when you were doing these shows, were they serious in your mind, or were they parodies of the show? I mean, were you doing them for real, or were...
No, it was real. I had a fantasy world that wouldn't quit, you know? I mean, I would... If I got on the back of a bus, I would go... If I got on a bus, I would go to the back of the bus, where the windows were kind of oval-shaped, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So that it would... I'd have more of a sense of riding in a limousine. Do you know what I mean? It's like, and if I looked out the window, or I'd pretend I was, you know, on an airplane taxing off, and fans said, you know, this is a 10. I was just intrigued by it. It wasn't something, it wasn't like Rupert Pumpkin, or wasn't it?
Rupert Pumpkin, yeah.
Yeah, it wasn't that sick, you know, it was clearly a fun hobby. You know, it was fun, and while other kids my age were protesting, you go to have a revolution, I was up in my room singing, weather-wise, it's such a cuckoo day, you know. But certainly in no way did it become something that I, you know, would answer to two different names or anything.
Did your imaginary show have a theme? A song?
No, there would be a production number, you know, kind of opening, which would be similar, where dancers come out and go, Marty, it's time for Marty. But, I mean, that wasn't a real theme.
Oh, what a nut.
Yeah. Sad, huh?
Terry Gross talking with Martin Short in 1989. Martin Short got his start doing sketch comedy on SCTV, where he created the characters Ed Grimley, Jackie Rogers Jr., and songwriter Irving Cohen. Later, he took those characters to Saturday Night Live. In Primetime Glick, Short wears a prosthetic fat suit and improvises with his celebrity guests by asking intentionally bizarre questions. Terry spoke with Martin Short about the creation of this new character last year. At that time, here's the way Jiminy treated guest star Ben Stiller.
There's so much I want to ask about. There's so much. Your father, let's talk about Jerry mm-hmm. Stiller. Mm-hmm. He's in the wonderful series Queer as Folk.
No.
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 What series is he in?
You're mistaken. He's on King of Queens.
Oh, that's what they're calling it now.
Yes.
And your mother is mm-hmm. Anne Heche, and she's had the worst time of it, hasn't she? She's had this because she thought she was a lesbian.
No.
And then she thought she was a normal person. And then before you know it, she's talking to aliens. How weird is it to be the daughter of clearly someone who's that insane?
I couldn't tell you that because, unfortunately, you've got her mixed up. It's not Anne Heche, it's Anne Mira.
Anne Mira!
Right.
See, I like her better than Anne Heche.
Yes.
Well, no
well,
wonder you've got different. All that DNA raising for you, all that comedic DNA that's got to be wonderful. Do you have demons, Ben Stiller?
I think we all have demons,
you
Jiminy.
Have demons.
Mm-hmm. I think we all do.
Martin Short, welcome back to Fresh Air. Let's start with Jiminy Glick. Can you give us, like, a capsule bio of who this character is?
Jiminy Glick is someone who... grew up, was privately tutored with his parents until he was around 28. Then he went out into the real world and saw a wonderful production of 40 Carats, touring with Lana Turner, auditioned, got in as onlooker number two, then went to Los Angeles, where for 6 years he worked at Chasen's as a busboy. And at one night catering a party at Roddy McDowell's, the very drunken George Schlatter, was helped home, declaring that a host for a syndicated show that he wanted had walked out because they didn't accept George's double scale approach. And after that, the rest is history. I was asked to do the show, and before you know it, I'm suddenly talking to the likes of yous.
Why is it so important for Jiminy Glick to always be in touch with celebrities?
I don't know. I think that Jiminy is someone who thrives on this shallow world of celebrity. When I started the show, and then it went on the air, and then I would read some response to it, only the positive, of course, that would claim great, you know, declarations of intent, you know, the ultimate satire of a form of a blanket of blank. And I would just say, absolutely. But it's not always true. Sometimes you set up by just saying that this character, if you met him in life, whether he was a teacher or whether he was a politician or whether he was a celebrity interviewer, would make you laugh because of his strange, sincere take on the world and how wrong it is.
And he has a great mix of self-involvement and insecurity.
Right. Where I can laugh at Jiminy objectively is when he gets very sincere and feels he's doing a hard-hitting, tough interview. And the finger is pointing. And he says in the show, which is, I think, with David Duchovny, he says, I worry about Robert Downey. Do you worry about Robert Downey? And Duchovny says, yes. He says, I feel like cornering him and saying, Bobby, stop it, and stay stopped it. And Duchovny says, I think that's what he needs. He needs someone to point their finger at him and say, stay stopped. And in Jiminy's world, he thinks he's doing exactly what Charlie Rose would do.
Are your interviews on Primetime Glick scripted? When you have on real celebrities and you're playing this satire of a celebrity interviewer, do the real celebrities know what you're going to ask in advance, and have they already had a chance to think through how they're going to respond?
No, none of it is planned, and none of it's scripted. No one knows what I'm going to say, and I don't know what I'm going to say. I have pages in front of me that have facts about the celebrity, and often I won't even look at it until the last second because Jiminy wouldn't look at it till the last second.
Right, and you have a way of choosing choosing the most unimportant movie that an actor's made to zero in on. Sometimes when you have an actor on the show who you're interviewing, they're clearly like trying to not totally crack up because they think what you're doing is really funny, but they want to stay in character as if this was a real show.
Right.
Do you advise them not to laugh, if at all possible?
No, what we used to, I know that when in last season when we were cutting some of the early shows, I was very self-conscious about them laughing. It seemed kind of cheesy to me that I would be executive producing the show that has people sitting back going, oh, Marty, how can I get through this? It felt a little self-serving. Then, as I would look at it again, I'd think, you know, I'm wrong. It's just, it's natural, that it's fun.
No, one of the things that the Jiminy Glick show does is break for commercials, as most broadcast shows do, but these are all satirical commercials. I thought maybe we could break for one of your commercials from Primetime Glick, and this is a commercial for the Independent Film Channel.
This Monday on the Independent Movie Channel's Best of the Fest, Robin Herker's Explaining Carlo, the explosive story of two young heroin addicts who drive cross-country and strike up a relationship with two Texas lesbians. Then on Tuesday, two different lesbians on their way to L.A. strike up a relationship with a heroin-addicted ex-security guard from Texas in Kira Sandoval's controversial The Wisdom of Sarah Finkelman. Then on Wednesday, two ex-lesbians are drawn back into their former lifestyle when they pick up three heroin-addicted hitchhikers.
That's one of the very funny satirical commercials from Martin Short's show Prime Time Glick. Do you write any of those commercials yourself?
Yes.
Good. They're very funny.
Yeah. Well, I work with two brilliant guys. One is Michael Short and one is Paul Flaherty. And the three of us create the show together.
Is Michael Short a relation?
Yes, he's a brother.
Uh-huh.
And my big brother, Mike.
Is Paul Flaherty related to...
Joe Flaherty,
Joe
brother.
Joe Flaherty, yeah.
Yep.
Oh, wow. All in the family.
They're all obviously I grew up with Michael, but I met Paul on SCTV, which Michael also wrote.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Nate, you said that when you were a kid, you really, you know, wanted to be a celebrity yourself. So do you feel like on some level you really understand Jiminy Glick's need to be famous and to be with famous people?
Well, I don't know if he needs to be with famous people as much as that for Jiminy, these shallow tidbits that make up his life are important. They're fascinating. But more importantly, society has rewarded him. He does have his own show. He does live in a nice house. He is watched. And he couldn't be less qualified to be in his position. He's not the only person in the entertainment world that has that position.
Martin Short speaking with Terry Gross in 2002. We'll have more of their conversation after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to more of Terry's interview from last year with Martin Short, star of Comedy Central's primetime Glick.
So when you were young and you were watching all these TV shows and doing your imaginary show, did you have any training? Did your mother say, send this boy to acting school or give him singing lessons, develop that talent?
No. My mother was the concert mistress of the symphony. She was the first female concertmaster, actually. So I grew up with, at times during the season, 5 hours of practice heard within the house on a violin. So the idea of rehearsal and opening night was not foreign. But no, I think growing up in Hamilton, Ontario, Canada, you don't instinctively, Broadway isn't down the street. So it all seems not terribly realistic. So it wasn't until I was in university and having done theater throughout university, realized that there was actually an acting scene in Toronto, Ontario, which was 40 miles away, and that it was not inconceivable to take a year off school and try it.
Did your mother measure talent according to more classical standards of rigorous studies and a more legit kind of singing voice than you probably had? You had a more pop voice.
No, you know what? It was very interesting. She was always very encouraging. In fact, when I was 15, Frank Sinatra had released an album called September of My Years. And I re-recorded that. I typed all the lyrics. And I had an attic bedroom, and the hallway to the bedroom was had an echo to it. So I set up my chair. I had a microphone, reel-to-reel. And I would play the introductions from the Sinatra album. But it would be, and of course, Frank was 53 and I was 14. But the introductions would be in his key, so it would be do 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 do, and here, click. Strangers in the night. Too long. I was in Frank's keys. But I would do the album, and it would take me about a week, I'd make up an album cover, and then my mother, I remember, listened to it and critiqued it because she used to adjudicate at certain, violin contests and things in her life. And so she wrote a synopsis a critique of each song, and this, the pitch was very good, lovely old song, well phrased at the end, hold the note too long here, and rated it as 4 stars, 3 stars, 3.5 stars, so I still have that.
Was that helpful?
It was helpful. I think it was mainly helpful because someone was taking my fantasy world very seriously and treating it with credibility and respect. Frank Sinatra once said that his father was always around to piss on his dreams. And I think it's very important for parents to constantly nurture and support eclectic interests of their children because you never know which one is going to become the fuel that drives their life.
Getting back to the to Primetime Glick, Jiminy Glick has a sidekick and band leader whose name is Adrian Von Voorhees, a great name I have to say, and he plays harp. Michael McKean plays the character. Can you talk about coming up with this character?
Well, I certainly didn't come up with the character Michael did, but we kind of wrote it in a direction. It was, you kind of find that the more things you do with characters, the more you come up with it. We'd be writing something and Michael would come in and he'd say, Michael said, I want to play him like he's older, but he wears a lot of makeup to hide it. So that becomes part of the character. Does he like Jiminy? He doesn't dislike Jiminy, but it's a job. So if Jiminy insults him or cuts him off, he goes, very good, no problem, because it's a job. In one of the episodes, his first wife, who's around 85, is on. It's one of those scenarios where we assume that he's married. His first wife was 20 years older. She's a horn player, and he just loses it. And there's a tape of Buddy Rich, pirated tape of Buddy Rich screaming at the band on a bus, wants his band. And so we made that Adrian Van Voorhees. So we come back from commercial, and he's just berating. Clams, you're hitting nothing but clams, you know. And so that's a new side of Adrian, the side of Adrian losing it. So that's what makes that stuff fun, is you keep saying, what if Adrian was in a bad mood this show, or what if Adrian gets hurt? I interviewed Michael last year, Michael McKean, as Adrian, and the idea was that Russell Crowe hadn't shown up, and now we had to interview Adrian Van Voorhees. And at one point, again, it's all improvised, I asked him something about, I made some comment about the fact that he wasn't terribly educated, that was that ever a limitation as a musician? And Michael's face completely changed, and he started to tear up, real tears. And there was a split second that even I, as Jiminy, thought, wait a second, have I mentioned something that's actually gotten Michael upset? I mean, it was so real. And he then proceeded to let me know, as Adrian Van Voorhees, that this was a very hurtful subject for him, and I could be hurtful sometimes and insensitive, and that he was always, you know, it was a sore spot for him, his lack of education. And it was an amazing exercise to watch, even after all these years of improvising, to see someone that into it and to make it that real.
So how did your character, Jiminy Glick, react when...
He became very, oh my God, Adrian, I so didn't mean that. I mean, he became a little bit attentive to the possibility that he'd gone too far. You know, Jiminy Glick has no intention of hurting anyone. And when people get upset, when they walk off or they storm out, what have I done? Someone explain to me what I have done. He doesn't know.
Well, Martin Short, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Martin Short speaking with Terry Gross in 2002. He's currently starring on TV in Comedy Central's primetime Glick and on stage in a Los Angeles production of the Mel Brooks musical The Producers opposite Jason Alexander. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of Villa Incognito, a novel by Tom Robbins, author of Fierce Invalids Home from Hot Climates. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The look of love is in your eyes.
Coming up, composer Burt Bacharach and lyricist Hal David. They wrote dozens of hits in the 60s and won just about every major music award. Bacharach turns 75 next week, and there's a new Broadway review built around their music.
Of love, it's saying so much more than just words could ever say. And what my heart has heard, well, it takes my breath away. I can hardly wait to hold you, feel my arms around you. How long I have waited.
just to love you. Now that I've found you, you've got the look of love. It's on your face, the look that time can't erase. Be mine tonight.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Biancooley. Burt Bacharach turned 75 on Monday, and in recent years has been enjoying a sort of personal renaissance. In 1998, the same year a box set retrospective of his old songs was released, he collaborated with Elvis Costello on a well-received collection of new songs. He was featured as himself in the Austin Powers movies and has had his songs performed by the singing contestants on TV's American Idol. Right now, the classic songs written in the 60s and 70s by Bacharach and Hal David are being showcased in a new Broadway musical called The Look of Love. It's a roundabout theater company production stringing together such hits as the title song, Alfie, and Promises, Promises, a song recorded originally by Dionne Warwick. Terry asked Burt Bacharach about that song when they spoke in 1998 when he and Elvis Costello were on Fresh Air. Here's the original recording of Promises, Promises.
Promises, promises, I'm all through with promises, promises now. I don't know how I got the nerve to walk out. If I shout, remember, I feel free. Now I can look at myself and be proud. I'm laughing. Promises, this is where those promises, promises end. I don't pretend that what was wrong can be right. Every night I'll sleep now, no more lies. Things that I promised myself fell apart, but I found my heart. Oh, promises, they're kind of promises.
When I, like, for instance, listened to Promises, Promises, I never thought to myself, gee, what a tricky set of time signature changes. But, and the sheet music, if you look at the sheet music, the line promises, those kind of promises take all the joy from life. There's one bar of 3/4, followed by a bar of 4/4, followed by a bar of 6/4, then 3/4, 4/4, then 6/4. And then promises, promises, my kind of promises, that's 3/4, 3/8, and then 4/8. I mean, who even sees 3/8 in sheet music? So, Burt Bacharach, these kind of shifts just come into your mind, and then you write them down, and that's when you realize how tricky they are?
Well, I think that was driven, yeah, that certainly was driven by the intensity of what that had to say theatrically on stage. And
right, because that was written for the show, Promises, Promises.
Right. So it had to have a drive of its own, and, yeah, heard it, played it, then started to notate it, write it down. Oh, my goodness, we got a 3/8 bar. And here comes another 3/8 bar, because it can't be a 6/8 bar, putting the two 3/8s together. It's a 3/8, it's a 3/8, it's a 4/8. And even when I'm doing it, like, with a symphony orchestra now, I try to get them to think, to add one thing. Instead of just counting the 3/8, 3/8, 4/8, to hear what the girls are singing or hear the musical content rather than reading those eighth notes and go, promises, promises, and one. So right there, that takes care of your 7/8 bar, you see? Promises, promises, and one. Bum, da, 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 da. But if they don't sing in their head, I mean, the background voices and the strings are playing, da, ba, da, ba, da, da. See? The girls are going, promises, promises. And the trumpet players have to come in one beat later. So it'd be promises, promises, bum, bum. But if they can hear in their head, promises, promises, and one. If they count that way, it's a breeze. It's simple.
So, and, music lesson for you.
Of course, the symphony orchestra sometimes would look at me with great dismay and say, what is this man saying?
Yeah. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that you can everyday work together throws up, you know. Obviously, we to go back to your question about harmonics, or harmony, I should say, I've written a good degree of music down, particularly when I've worked with musicians from the classical and jazz field who are more used to the written page. But when it comes to popular song, of course, working in a rock band, you hardly ever write anything down. Sometimes a string overlay of a rhythm section, but the rhythm section parts, the chord progressions are very simple, and it would be stupid to write them down. They're too easy to remember. You would inhibit yourself in the communication.
But don't you think that orchestration aside, that a lot of rock musicians don't even know most of the chords or many of the chords that Bacharach would use in his compositions? You know, that the more complicated jazz chords, for instance.
Very possible.
Or they stumble on them and they don't know them by name, or they don't know them instantly. But you do hear some very complex things happen in records that they're just not necessarily schooled in.
Because
Right.
But, the interesting thing for me is the rock musicians, and this is a generalization, that have trouble there and don't necessarily play that minor second and that chord, or don't hear it, or don't understand how to hear it enough to play it on the guitar or on the keyboard. I find that like the same level of not knowing, not being able to translate onto paper what they play. R&B players, it's a different thing. Yeah. They go to the minor second like it's in their system, in their blood. Yeah. It's a natural thing. They go into different kind of loops, both rhythmically and harmonically. Because it's and they may not be able to write it down.
Yeah, there's also the other side of it, isn't there? That it can be a loop, and you get jazz players who defer to particular intervals that allow them to speak in a language that's understood by other jazz musicians. But that you're starting to hear these voicings all the time, and they can't play a playing chord. They couldn't play a playing chord. It's almost like a heresy to them. And I think there's a little bit of a trap in that only Absolutely. Being able to voice in complex harmony and to not see that there is a beautiful thing in
Williams'
song with just playing harmony.
I understand that when I have to go to a choice of do I end it with just a straight C triad?
Yeah.
Well, Burt Bacharach, what influenced you harmonically? What music were you listening to that you think formed your basic, musical harmonic mind?
I think when I did get interested in music, it certainly was the French Impressionist, Ravel, Debussy, and Rachmaninoff. And suddenly to hear what was going on in the world of jazz opposed to the world of jazz that I knew before, coming from listening to the Dorsey Band or Harry James. And suddenly somebody opened this giant door and there was Dizzy Gillespie and Tad Dameron and Charlie Parker, Thelonious Monk. It was like another light years away.
And why do you think that rather than becoming, say, a bop musician or bop composer arranger, you went into pop instead?
Oh, I don't think I would ever been a good enough jazz pianist, bop pianist. I was influenced by it. But the same reason I never became a serious classical composer, starting with Darius Milhaud and Henry Cowell. It was a learning process. I liked the music, appreciated the music. I always felt that if I pursued it, I'd be writing maybe on a commission from a symphony, that I'd hear the work 2 years later. I'd have to supplement my income or make money teaching at a university. It's a hard row, I like a nice place to live in, and I wasn't going to get it that way. I like the comfort level a little too high. And the other thing is, I just didn't want to do it enough. Maybe that's the biggest, but there'll never be a regret coming from me, where I'll say, oh, God, it just been different if I'd written that one great symphony. Well, that's off the list. That's just a fabrication in my mind for me to ever say. Yeah. I had one regret that my mother was so disappointed because Leopold Stokowski asked me to write a piece years ago, probably when Promises, Promises was out there, and I was commissioned by the American Symphony. And, they said, we'll premiere it in 3 years. And I was used to the gratification, you know, of write a song, go into the studio, make the record, and hear it on the way home. Hear it on the way home or the next morning when you turn on the radio. 3 years.
That's a long time, isn't
it? Long time. And I took a pass, and I was fine taking a pass on it. But
my
mother was very disappointed.
Yeah. Burt Bacharach speaking with Terry Gross in 1998. We'll hear more of their conversation after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Burt Bacharach.
If you see me walking down the street and I start to cry each time we meet, walk on by.
Bacharach, I mean, your arrangements are filled with flugelhorns and trumpets. I mean, there's so many songs of yours where that's just, I've come to think of it as a signature. I was wondering if you ever played trumpet or, you know, why you hear trumpets in so many of your songs.
It's a very expressive instrument. For a singular, it's one of the few instruments when I could say, make a statement set up on an intro or a figure. It speaks more vocal than like a flute would have, or clarinet, or a saxophone is a little bit of another picture. But I used to write dummy lyrics on flugelhorn parts, just on introduction things, just so they weren't just notes. So the flugelhorn player would be able to see the note, sing the note, even though it made no sense. It was a lyric, but it made no sense. But it just had the right sound, vocally, vowel-wise, for that right note. Trumpet players in the original times when we were recording, till they got to know me, thought I was nuts. But there is something about it, you know? Just say, sing it.
I want to play another record here, and I thought that we'd play the Elvis Costello version of the Burt Bacharach Hal David song, I Just Don't Know What to Do with Myself.
Oh my God!
And this is a great song, and there's great recordings of it. Elvis, I love your version of it, and then there's of course the Dusty Springfield version, which is a classic. And on the new Rhino box set, it also features the original version of the song by Tommy Hunt. So before we hear all three versions, Burt Bacharach, would you tell us about writing the song?
In the Brill Building days, where Hal and I would work every day, we had a whole roster of Scepter artists that were potentially artists to record. And I guess that was going to be either for Chuck Jackson or for Tommy Hunt. And I went in, wrote the orchestration, made the record with Tommy. And that was the initial record. I liked the record. I liked the way he sang, too. So, you know, every other record afterwards is a different record in a way than what the original was.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they might be better, but You know, they can't, the original often comes right out of the bed with me.
So after Tommy Hunt recorded I Just Don't Know What to Do with Myself, did you rethink the song for Dusty Springfield when you arranged it for her?
No, Dusty, I didn't do Dusty. Dusty did it with whoever was writing arrangements.
I think one of the things, we've been through this process because being as this is the song that I have the longest history with as a professional singer, we wanted to include this song in our concerts, in our recent concerts. And, of course, it's a question. The parts for that original Tommy Hunt record are long lost, and it was a question of having somebody transcribe a hybrid from the two records, because I learned the song from Dusty's version, and that's imprinted on my mind. And we went back and had the skeleton of the arrangement transcribed back, and you can hear how whoever transcribed this record, it's a shameless copy in certain respects of your orchestration, but there are certain voicings that are wrong. If you compare them, actually, you know, they're wrong, you might say, in the sense they've misheard what's going on in the Tommy Hunt version. They're so trying to keep so close to it. I don't think they've changed them deliberately. I think they're just mishearing. And if you listen on to Me and the Attractions stumbling through it in 1977, you'll hear still a further mishearing of a chord or two. And that's part of it. You know, I get slightly embarrassed when I hear that record now, because I hear the naivety of the approach, but also hear the feeling
that's
in all of these versions. And the one thing, that is a journey that a song can go on. And I mean, some of Bert's songs have gone on more extraordinary journeys. If you listen to I Say a Little Prayer as done by Aretha Franklin or as done by Roland Kirk, you'll hear an even more radical transformation,
Well, right now, why don't we hear I Just Don't Know What to Do with Myself? And first we'll hear Tommy Hunt, then Dusty Springfield, then Elvis Costello.
I just don't know what to do with myself. Don't know just what to do with myself. I'm so used to doing everything with you, planning everything for two. And now that we're through, I just don't know what to do
with my time. I'm so lonesome for you, it's a crime. Going to a movie only makes me sad. Parties make me feel as bad when I'm not with you. I just don't know what to do. Like a summer rose needs a sun and rain. I need your sweet love to be all pain.
I just don't know what to do with myself. I just don't know what to do with myself.
Those are three versions of the Burt Bacharach, Hal David song. And we heard Tommy Hunt, then Dusty Springfield, then Elvis Costello. And my guests are Elvis Costello and Burt Bacharach. Burt Bacharach, when did you first hear Elvis Costello's version of that?
You know, I'm not sure. I did back when it was recorded. I did hear Elvis do it about 4 years ago live at the Troubadour. It was Steve Naive, piano, an acoustic concert. And I thought it was brilliant. You know, it was great. I often, you know, I have to confess, I often did not listen to covers or things that would come in. I don't defend that position. If Elvis's record had come in and somebody called it my attention, what is it, 1974? Was that when
77.
When that record came in, I think probably at the time, I wasn't listening to anything, any covers that were coming in, you know.
Uh-huh. I think anyway, that's a fairly obscure release. You know, it wasn't like a single where we covered it and tried to, you know, there were hits,
is my nature. Yeah. What it's been is, well, that was written, that's done. Somebody else did that. Elvis Costello did it, great. Yeah, yeah. But not, you know, I was too into, okay, we got to work today. We got to write something.
right.
The next song. I was into the next song of it rather than.
Yeah.
I figure when I stop writing and ancient, then they'll bring in all these old records. And I'll spend the last days of my life listening to all the records of my songs that I never heard.
Burt Bacharach and Elvis Costello speaking with Terry Gross in 1998. Coming up, we hear from lyricist Hal David. This is Fresh Air. As part of our salute to Burt Bacharach, who turned 75 on Monday, let's listen to Terry's 1997 interview with Hal David, Bacharach's most significant musical collaborator. You probably know lots of Hal David's lyrics by heart. Lyrics to such songs as The Look of Love, What the World Needs Now, Do You Know the Way to San Jose, I Say a Little Prayer, Walk on By, What's New Pussycat, and Alfie. Bacharach and David's collaboration lasted from the late 50s to the mid-70s.
You and Burt Bacharach have each said that Alfie is your favorite song, or at least right on top there. Why is Alfie your favorite?
Well, in writing songs, we're always trying to be as good as we can be, try to be at our very best. We're not always at our very best. I think that's an impossibility for anyone. And then there are time constraints when there are recording sessions to go into films where the song has got to be produced in a given amount of time, and a theater piece where it's got to go in very quickly. So consequently, you let go of songs sometimes before it's every bit as good as you hoped it would be. I think with Alfie, in my case at least, that song came as close to being the way I wanted that a song to be.
If I were a lyricist, this is an assignment I don't think I would have wanted. Write a title theme for a movie called Alfie about a womanizer who, you know, really mistreats the women in his life. Mm-hmm. Seems like a tough assignment. You did good. What did you think when you got this assignment?
I thought to myself, my God, why do they keep giving me these terrible assignments? It seems such an odd phrase, Alfie. It was not a name that spelled any sort of romance whatsoever. It sounded almost like a music hall, a British music hall kind of song. And it took me a while to find my way into the song, which was the opening line, what's it all about? And suddenly I had a sense of where I should go.
What's it all about, Alfie? Is it just for the moment we live? What's it all about when you sort it out, Alfie? Are kind.
then I guess it is wise to be cruel. And if life belongs only to the strong, Alfie, what will you lend on?
In the bridge, it doesn't really rhyme. You know, as sure as I believe there's a heaven above, Alfie, I know there's something much more, something even non-believers can believe in. Tell me about doing that without a rhyme.
Well, now that you asked the question, I hadn't even thought of it, and I don't think I even thought that it didn't have a rhyme. You bring it to my attention. That's just exactly how I heard the lyric going. I wrote that lyric for the most part first, and Bert wrote the music afterwards. He wrote a brilliant melody. I just heard those lines, and the structure of the lines was the way I thought it should fall in the bridge of the song. And I now know I didn't have a rhyme in the bridge, and that's interesting for me.
Hal David, speaking with Terry Gross in 1997. A new musical review of his compositions with Burt Bacharach, called The Look of Love, has just opened on Broadway. Bacharach celebrates his 75th birthday on Monday.
What's new, pussycat? Whoa! What's new, pussycat? Whoa, 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 whoa. Pussycat, pussycat, I've got flowers and...
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli.
What's new, pussycat? Whoa, whoa, whoa. What's new, pussycat? Whoa, 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 whoa. Pussycat, pussycat, you're so thrilling and I'm so willing to care for you. So go and make up your big little pussycat eyes. Pussycat, pussycat, I love you. Yes, I do. You and your pussycat eyes. What's new, pussycat? Whoa, whoa, whoa. What's new, pussycat? Whoa, whoa, whoa.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Toms of Maine, maker of natural care products and creator of the Rivers Awareness Program to preserve the nation's waterways. Information at participating stores or tomsofmaine.com. And from Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of Villa Incognito, a novel by Tom Robbins, author of Fierce Invalids Home from Hot Climates. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Now if you feel that you can't go on, because all of your hope is gone.
On the next Fresh Air, the songwriting trio behind some of Motown's biggest hits, Brian Holland, Lamont Dozier, and Edward Holland. They receive a BMI Icon Award May 13th. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Don't